We asked you what you hear when politicians like Governor Rauner speak. Here's one response.
I think liar, liar, pants on fire.
And this morning, Don Gagne hearing another perspective from a Trump rally in Ohio.
This is the double standard between liberals and conservatives.
How so?
Well, you know, the liberals can't, you know, they don't like the truth.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of The 21st. Today, what's our political divide doing to this country and to our state? We're talking perception versus reality. And here's my question for you listening. When was the last time you learned something from someone you disagreed with politically? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Later, two student entrepreneurs are hoping to change the game in prosthetic manufacturing with 3D printing technology. That's coming up this hour of the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm your host, Nyla Boodoo. Friday night in Chicago, we saw an example of how bitter this presidential race has become. Protests between supporters and detractors of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump turned violent. Trump canceled his planned rally. And all weekend, we've been hearing accusations fly about who started what and how divided we are as a country politically. Today, we're talking about perception versus reality when it comes to what politicians say and what we hear. I'm excited you've tuned into our very first broadcast of this show. We are calling this program the 21st because it's all about our state. And Illinois, by the way, if you did not know, is the 21st state. Our goal is to set a new standard for conversation in Illinois. For those of you listening right now, this is a conversation you're not just welcome to join. It's a conversation we can't have without your participation. That said, you can always tweet your questions or comments to us at 21st Show. And here's my question for all of you listening right now. Can you share a story about when you learned something from someone you disagreed with politically? Was there a time when you were able to cross that divide? Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455, and you can tweet at 21st Show. This polarization is something everyone from political scientists to the White House are worried about. And of course, it's not just national politics. We're seeing this play out right here in Illinois with an unprecedented stalemate between our Democratic legislature and a Republican governor. But right now, we're going to start with the national scene. And this issue of what we hear versus what politicians say was the topic of a recent Washington Post story by White House correspondent Greg Jaffe. And Greg joins us now from the Washington Post. Greg, welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You know, I wanted you to be here because you wrote this fascinating story that helped inspire our program today. And it started with two tweets reacting both in support and against President Obama to people who were listening to the State of the Union address. What did they say?
You know, it was just interesting how two people kind of heard what he was talking about. You know, he was trying to talk about polarization and the need for us to sort of come together and listen to each other. And what was striking about the two tweets was just how they heard completely different things. You know, one very much looked at the Republicans in the audience that night at the State of the Union and expressed frustration with them for not clapping or responding to his message in any way. And the other expressed frustration with President Obama, feeling like he had contributed to the polarization and now he was complaining about it after having kind of caused the problem.
And I wanted to play President Obama. That was him during the State of the Union. But he was here in Illinois not too long ago when he was in Springfield. And let's hear what he had to say about the partisan divide at that point.
So you don't have within each party as much diversity of views. And you've got a fractured media. Some folks watch Fox News. Some folks read the Huffington Post. And very often, what's profitable is the most sensational conflict and the most incendiary sound bites. And we can choose our own facts. We don't have a common basis for what's true and what's not. I mean, if I listened to some of these conservative pundits, I wouldn't vote for me either. I sound like a scary guy.
That's President Obama on his recent trip to Springfield to address the legislature. My guest with me right now is Greg Jaffe. He covers the White House for The Washington Post. Greg, how much is the White House worried about what President Obama just said there?
You know, I think they're really, really worried about it. Part of the reason they're concerned is, I mean, certainly the rise of Trump has contributed to that. They look at what's going on in the election, and I think the president is really disturbed by that. He was really disturbed earlier this year when the Republican candidates were calling for sort of a religious test on things like Syrian refugees. And so I think he's worried that the country, if it goes too far down this path, starts to do things that compromise its values. And then I think there's a broader worry that if we can't have normal conversations, if we can't listen to each other, then our political process just doesn't function. And I think there's a feeling in the White House that we're moving precipitously close to that point.
And that's obviously something that they're worried about playing out, not just in the presidential office, but I imagine permeating through all of politics.
No, that was the exact quote from the president's political advisor, David Seamus, who said to me, you know, this is not just a problem for us at the national level. It's something that's happening in every state legislature and every town hall in America.
Right, which, of course, we're seeing here in Illinois. How, Greg, you are someone who obviously cover the White House. You're listening to the president's speeches all the time. How is the White House trying to handle this?
You know, it's a tough one for them. They'll say it's a devilishly tough problem. Part of the way that they're trying to handle it is having the president talk to kind of common values that all Americans share. You know, and as that was something he did in the State of the Union, it was something he did in Illinois, it was something he did when he did a town hall meeting on CNN regarding the gun debate, where they had kind of critics of his policy come in and he talked with them or tried to address their concerns. But it's a tough one for them. There are logistical barriers to his kind of hearing people who are different than who have different opinions than he. And then there are just some sort of practical and political barriers.
Right. I know that you talk to a lot of political scientists doing your research for the story, and we did as well. And we spoke to a professor at the University of Illinois named David Tewksbury. I wanted to hear what he said, and I wanted to play for you all. We spoke to him earlier talking about whether or not we're divided as a country, actually. Let's hear what he had to say about that.
The data, we're actually kind of mixed on this. There are a fair number of folks who have said, yeah, we're more polarized when we say things like, you know, more people have strong sort of left or right-leaning opinions. There's some data for that. But then if you look at things like the number of people who align with a Democratic or Republican Party, that hasn't gone up. In fact, actually, the number of people who are independent is still very, very high. And the people going in and out of the Democratic and Republican parties are kind of on the margins. So there actually is less evidence of party polarization, but maybe some evidence of maybe sort of issue polarization. People less willing to talk to each other in a calm manner about particular issues like, you know, abortion or gun control or something like that. So I think it's a mixed story.
That's David Tewksbury, a professor and head of the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois, and he also teaches classes in political science. Greg, when you talk to other political scientists across the country, I imagine they agreed with David, Professor Tewksbury, on that we're not necessarily more polarized in our actual political beliefs, just maybe how we're expressing them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of them described it to me like a sports team, you know, that you root against one team's, but, you know, it's not rooted in any kind of particular necessarily ideology or philosophy, but it's just sort of a visceral thing, an emotional thing.
Right. And I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Joe Yoon leads the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab. And Joe, he's in studio with me now. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
You ran a little experiment for us to help better understand some of the social media on how what we're hearing about this. What did you do?
So basically what we did was we took two camps of people that we thought might be separate groups of people. We took people on social media, on Twitter specifically, that seemed to be very much supporters of Bernie Sanders, and people that seemed to be very much supporters of Trump. And we actually, for the past year, we downloaded all of their tweets, and we ran them through a linguistics program that would give us certain person attributes, person type attributes, such as, you know, where do they range with regards to analytical thinking, you know, depending on how their tweets are processed, what's their overall tone, is it positive, is it negative, how confidently do they speak online, et cetera. And what we were potentially expecting to see is that when we compared those two statistically, that maybe there's different types of people that support Trump versus Sanders. But what we found was overall there was not any sort of large statistical difference between the two, that the person type attributes, they were pretty much consistent across both groups.
And I wonder when you think about that, so these person type attributes, I should say, these are sort of standards that psychologists have used for decades. And so you're kind of doing new, more cutting edge research because you're applying this to social media expression.
Correct.
Right? I wonder if the very fact that it's social media it's sort of a medium where whoever's speaking loudest, it's sort of a medium that rewards people speaking loudly, right? So does that, do you think, skew things?
Absolutely. What's interesting about social media is this concept of influential people on social media. You know, we obviously have people like Taylor Swift or Beyonce that naturally would be influential in the world, and they all are also influential on social media. But what's interesting is that there are certain people on social media, just because of how they've built connections, that although they might be completely unknown on the outside world, within social media, they have grown to become very influential with regards to where they sit in the overall network of the social media feeds. And so when they say certain things, whether it be an extreme position or extreme view, that might actually reverberate very quickly and very powerfully within their realms of social media because of their influence that they have on that medium.
And Greg, I wonder, going back to Greg Jaffe from the Washington Post, Greg, I wonder how you, as we think about how we're sort of, I imagine the White House has put a lot of effort into this as well, right? Because social media, President Obama sort of revolutionized that when he was running for office in terms of how he used that to communicate with people. But now, 8 years later, we're sort of seeing where we are really self-segregating on social media, aren't we, Greg? I mean, I wonder how that changes. Do you think that's changing the tone of political conversation nationally?
Yeah, no, that's a big frustration of the White House. Dennis McDonough, the president's chief of staff, said earlier this year that you can choose your news media the way you choose your neighborhood. You know, you self-segregate so that you're just getting opinions that reinforce your own, and it makes it really hard for the White House to communicate to the country as a whole. So that's something that they're trying to work around. You know, one way they tried to do it after this most recent State of the Union was they had the president do interviews with several YouTube stars who had nothing to do with politics, and that was sort of a way of talking to folks through a different channel, trying to get around some of this.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, Greg, as you listened to what Joe did, were you surprised that he didn't really find very much differences between Trump supporters and Bernie supporters?
I actually was pretty shocked. I would have thought that they would have been pretty different demographically and in a whole myriad of ways, so that the sense that they look or sound or have similar attributes. That's really surprising to me.
And when you think about, Greg, when you talk to different political scientists about this, what are we seeing in terms of research? I know when you and I talked earlier, one of the things that was surprising to you was when we look at how we are as a country, we're actually pretty moderate politically. People are kind of picking and choosing their own platforms of things they want. But what are political scientists saying is different about the way we're expressing or the way we're feeling about politics right now?
Yeah, you know, Trump's a good example. I mean, he's all over the map ideologically, right? And his supporter, you know, his conservative Republicans will say, well, he's not really a conservative because he doesn't sort of subscribe to these various views. So in some ways, he reflects that sort of mass that's all over the map ideologically. But what he also reflects is this tone that's very strident, that's very angry, that has trouble sort of submitting to any kind of compromise or any kind of conversation. And that's really what I think political scientists worry about.
Mm-hmm. And how do political scientists say we can change this?
And that's the really hard part. I mean, it's hard to change because if it's a policy-oriented dispute, you know, something that's rooted in sort of fundamental policy differences, you can kind of compromise on that, right? But if it's just rooted in sort of an emotion, a sort of a disgust with the other side, it becomes really, really hard to compromise and really hard to listen. I mean, one way they found is that if you put people in small groups and have, you know, discussions with small groups that are sort of mediated, you can get around this. But it's hard to have, you know, 250 million small discussion groups every year.
Right. Well, we can have a small discussion group here on the 21st show, right? So if you want to share a story about when you learned something from someone you disagreed with politically, if there was a time you were able to cross that divide, you can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Before I let you go, Greg, you know, I wanted to ask you, we often hear democracy is messy, right? And we've certainly heard President Obama talking about examples of how divisive we are with our politics. What have you heard in your reporting about how this moment compares to previous eras?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer to that. I mean, President Obama likes to talk about that. You know, we no longer have canings on the Senate floor. You know, certainly compared
so
to
that's devices, that's an improvement, right?
right, yes. Yeah, certainly compared to the divisiveness of the Civil War, you know, where you have a country that breaks apart and people are killing each other. You know, it's clearly not hard to argue that it's been worse in our history, but that probably shouldn't be the standard that we, you know, try and achieve.
Joe, you know, as we think about this and as you think about the work that you do with social media analytics, I wonder, do you think that social media can help this or hurt this, or where do you come down on all of this?
Well, I think it can go both ways. You know, just this past weekend, as I was analyzing the different conversations for Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, you know, what I realized was one comment somebody made, they said that we're in the Bernie Sanders circles. You know, who are all these people that are supporting Trump? And, you know, that really brought more evidence to the fact that what they see is only within their own networks of social media. That's people that are surrounded that are similar to them. And I think what President Obama has done with regards to going to YouTube stars, I think that can actually be furthered on social media, that you could actually identify with regards to these different circles of conversation on social media, find those influential leaders and reach out to them in ways that are beyond social media, maybe in person or whatnot, and really start to kind of, you know, knock away at each one of these groups and just say, hey, can I just join this conversation and can I potentially bring some different thoughts into this so that we can, you know, converse about this reasonably. And I think that might be a way that you could really use social media overall for this.
And really quickly, also, it's interesting generationally, millennials also maybe are much more open, we've seen with research, to listening to different opinions on social media.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. All right. That's Joe Yoon. He's leader of the Social Media Analytics Lab at the University of Illinois. The Social Media Analytics Lab is with the College of Media at the U of I, and we're going to be working with Joe's team throughout this primary and election season to bring their data to our audience at the 21st. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Greg Jaffe, also, who covers the White House for The Washington Post. Thanks, Greg. We're talking about how deeply divided the ways we are, what we interpret what politicians are saying, and how that's playing out in an election where many say the country's growing more and more polarized. In 2 minutes, we're going to talk about what that means here in a state that's already so divided. There's been no budget for 8 months. How political scientists are saying we can change that dynamic. Stay with us. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It doesn't just feel like American politics have gotten more divisive. There's no data to back that up, too. Surveys from the American National Election Study show that both Democrats and Republicans are significantly more likely to dislike members of the other party than they were 15 years ago. We're talking about perception versus reality and how this polarization plays out right here in Illinois. And we're asking you, those of you who are listening, to join us by sharing a story of when you've been able to bridge the political divide. When have you learned something from someone you disagreed with politically? You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your questions or comments to us at 21st Show. Joining me now from Chicago are Kristen McQuarrie, she's on the Chicago Tribune editorial board, and Maria de los Angeles Torres, who's the executive director of UIC's Inter-University Program for Latino Research. Kristen, I should call you Nena, right? Thanks for being with me on the 21st.
Good morning. Hello. Nice to be with you.
Kristen, let's start with you and where this divide, you know, before the break, we were talking about national politics and where we are and a lot about rhetoric, but I wanted to shift the conversation to the actual consequences of what we're facing here in Illinois. And where are we at right now, 8 months without a budget?
Well, there are two issues kind of swirling right now. You have the governmental problem and you have a political problem. The governmental problem is that we don't have a budget, and so we are starting to see very tangible results of that. Our bill backlog, the number of bills that we can't pay in the state, is climbing above $7 billion. You're seeing layoffs at social service agencies like Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities. And these are groups that provide meals for seniors, homelessness support, that rely on state funding and are owed more than $30 million to these two charity charities combined. Then you're seeing state universities, which aren't getting paid. Eastern Illinois University laid off 200 workers last week. Chicago State has declared a financial emergency. So those are the very tangible results of what lacking a budget does to the state. On the political side, the two people who are really warring over that budget are the freshman Republican governor, Bruce Rauner, and the Democratic House Speaker, Michael Madigan. They are at loggerheads in the primary tomorrow. We have our, we're part of the mini Super Tuesday. Tomorrow is our primary election, and they are fighting each other in a lot of districts around the state, putting candidates up against each other. So until that is resolved, until we get through the primary, we probably won't see a result to the governmental problem.
This is Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune. Nana Torres, you're at UIC. I mean, where are you seeing this play out at the university level?
Well, we're the only public research university in the city of Chicago, and most of our students are actually first-generation college-bound. We educate working-class students from across the state, and we are having to dip into our reserves in order to pay scholarship. UIC, we have a very high percentage of students who are on scholarship. These are supposed to be state-funded scholarships. Our reserves are thin. We're a fairly new university. So what we're seeing is the deterioration of our buildings. We are in a hiring freeze in terms of faculty. The faculty that's here has not been able to, you know, update some of the basic kinds of infrastructures in the classroom. So what we're seeing is that there is really an abandonment of what was that commitment to public education, and particularly higher public education in the context of the economy that we live in. And I think, Nyla, when we sort of link this to what is occurring nationally in the deterioration in our political systems and in our really our commitment for democracy, democracy relies on institutions. They're the media and on education. And the commitment in the last, I would say, 30, 40 years has been diminishing, particularly in higher education. And so it is, I mean, I think the results of what we're seeing, obviously there were decisions by the Republican Party that we can talk a little bit more about, maybe indecisions from the Democratic Party here in the state of Illinois. But most importantly, it's the deterioration of the institutions of democracy.
Kristen, do you think that people are so busy blaming each other's party that maybe the sort of the average person isn't necessarily holding both parties accountable for what's happening right now at the state level?
You know, I think at the state level, it's the public has become much more educated and in tune with what's going on. So I think people, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, except for those outliers who are, you know, way to the left or way to the right, I actually think people are spreading the blame around. I think people understand that Governor Rauner has, you know, really come after public employee unions. He's trying to negotiate over things that people believe are not budget-related in the middle of a budget negotiation. People understand that. They also understand that, you know, he came to Springfield to shake things up, to turn this economy around. And so you can't just keep giving Springfield a blank check. If you're going to raise taxes, it has to come with reform. So I would say that more often than not, at this point, because it's been going on for so long, people do see both sides.
And I know we were talking earlier about how when we look at where we are as a country, sort of our ideology, we're kind of all over the map politically, and people sort of pick and choose issues they want. Kristen, I wonder how you see this being expressed in Illinois, and particularly being such a state that's been known to be such a Democratic stronghold. I wonder how that plays out if you're a Republican in Illinois, and particularly for the politics of our new Republican governor.
Well, it's interesting because I think you see at the state level what you see at the national level, people who are very loyal to either party, but particularly in this state, the Democratic Party, where they have blinders on a little bit because we didn't get to this financial crisis overnight. This has been building for, you know, the past 20 years, and 12 of those years, Democrats had exclusive control over state government, and they just continued to spend more than what was coming in. They also have a supermajority. They could pass a tax hike or whatever they wanted to resolve the problem. But you still have people who are just so loyal to the brand that they kind of refuse to acknowledge that, in the same way that you have Republicans to some extent on board with Governor Rauner and unable to see where he has had some missteps. You know, we are a pretty blue union state. Some of our public employee unions in this state are among the most powerful and influential in the country. So coming out as soon as he was elected and kind of going after that base was probably a mistake on his part. But to your point of state versus national, I think you do see that where, you know, people will only want to watch Fox News. People will only want to watch, you know, the liberal side. And it's the same here where you have some Democrats who are so loyal that they kind of fail to see the larger picture and on the Republican side as well.
But if I can jump in on this,
go ahead, Dana.
Nyla,
mm-hmm.
I think that we also had a tradition of moderate Republicans. And if there is one major change in the landscape, is in the Republican Party itself. I mean, we also, you know, we had the Jim Edgards and Jim Thompsons of the world that were moderate Republicans that were fiscally more, if you will, conservative than the Democrats were, who tried to bring in reform to the state level, but in such ways that did not destroy the entire fabric of state government, both its safety net as well as its responsibility and its role in the economic development, including the educational piece. So I think that if we see, you know, historically speaking, again, in the last 25 years, has been this dramatic kind of change, sea change in the Republican Party itself, to where we do have a governor that is slash and burn. And I think that is the most drastic, if you will, change that I've been able to note in state politics.
Kristen, do you agree?
I mean, I would say part of that, yes, I do agree. But I think the movement to a more conservative Republican Party is in reaction to the overspending and the years of, you know, not properly funding pensions. And so people are not looking for a moderate governor who's going to kind of like go along with the Democrats anymore. They want someone who's, you know, going to drop the gauntlet because we're a mess. I mean, our state is not paying its bills. Our credit rating keeps getting dropped. We are borrowing money to pay day-to-day expenses. We can't pay for kids who have autism. I mean, that's not Bruce Rauner's fault, in my opinion. That is years and years of overspending. And because of that, the Republican Party has gotten more extreme and has moved to the right.
Right, and I would say, I mean, we pay one of the lowest income taxes in the entire country as well. So as long as the revenue part of this is not taken up by both parties, we will continue to be having these kinds of fiscal issues.
Well, and as, I mean, the policy debate aside, as both of you are sort of presenting both sides of this, I wonder to ask about tomorrow, an election day. Kristen, let me start with you. How much do you think of our local races tomorrow are a reflection of first of all, let's start in Chicago. I wonder how much you think that's a representation at the national level of a referendum against Mayor Emanuel.
You know, I really don't see that we have one Cook County state's attorney's race that it kind of is a reflection of Emanuel in the sense that we had major protests over the shooting of Laquan McDonald and the way that case was handled. And you might see a turn in the state's attorney's office that pivots basically on that case. But other than that, I have not. The mayor has been kind of lying low, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen too many. Aside from that one race, too many races that are sort of a reflection on him.
What about for the rest of the state? How much more do you see local races being a referendum against Governor Rauner?
Very much so. I mean, because you have, you know, the Democratic Party against the Republican Party in the state for years, the Republican Party didn't have as much financing because they are not in power, and we all know special interest groups, whether they're right or left, they fund the people in power. So the Democrats have always been able to outspend the Republicans. This is one of the first times we're Republicans because we have a billionaire governor who is funding a lot of these campaigns is able to try to go head-to-head with the Democrats. So in a few key races, it's basically Rauner's credibility on the line. I mean, he's trying to fight back some people who he sees as you know, obstructing his agenda, et cetera. And so if he loses some of these key races tomorrow where he's spending a lot of money, it will be a serious setback for him as governor.
Nina, what's your sense of how people are feeling about tomorrow in the election?
Well, I think one thing to watch is what's going to happen in the city of Chicago in the Democratic primary. And I do think that there are a lot of the forces around the Chuy Garcia candidacy are rallying around Bernie Sanders. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in that particular race. You know, I think that, again, we just had, you know, the visit of Donald Trump to the University of Illinois canceled last week. I think there's, you know, tensions are flying high. I think people are not finding their voice in a certain sense in any one of the Democratic parties candidates. I mean, and I think, again, you know, you probably talked a lot about the Bernie Sanders, but I think that there's still people feeling that they're not quite reflected. And on the other hand, I think that there are people who feel that they've been left out and are expressing their anger and their alienation through the Trump. I think this is going to be a heated summer, and I don't see where the decorum that is necessary for democracies, I'm not sure where that's going to come from. And I hope that the media, and I'm not talking about newspapers here.
Or public radio.
Or public radio. But, you know, it's like fanning the fires, and any little thing gets turned into this huge controversy when, in reality, not everything is a huge controversy. Some things are just disagreements.
Ladies, we just have a few more minutes left, and I wanted to wrap up by asking both of you how much you think this local and national election is a turning point in our country in terms of in terms of what we believe in. Kristen, let's start with you.
Wow. I mean, to think that we are at this point where we got through Super Tuesday, we're about to hit mini Super Tuesday, and our state is still sort of at play, and Donald Trump is the nominee. I mean, I think it just turned the whole political apparatus on its head. The media was wrong. The pundits were wrong. The money didn't necessarily win this one, because Jeb Bush was outspending in almost all those early states, and people just kind of assumed this was going to be Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton. And then Bernie Sanders is hanging in there. So I just think it sort of blows up the whole model and shows us that, you know, you can't just listen to media people, myself included. You know, we don't.
Is that an advertisement to not read the Chicago Tribune editorial?
Don't read a word. I mean, we misread the anger in this country, and so to me, it's just kind of we're hitting the reset button.
Nina Torres.
Well, I was raised in Texas, so not that I necessarily always want to be right about these issues, but I think that there has been a long strategy here, particularly on the part of the Republicans, it was a Southern strategy. And it was a strategy that was based on, number one, taking away your people who were upset about the civil rights movement, and that the Democrats were, you know, going into more integrationist, if you will, kinds of perspective. That has been building up. They also reached out to the Latino community, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of people talk about the Southern strategy, but they don't talk about the outreach that Republicans did to the Latino community. At the end, those two, if you will, almost irreconcilable sets of groups set up for this kind of tension, I think, in the Republican Party. And the Democrats, frankly, have taken the Latino vote for granted and the African-American vote for granted. And so I think that, in part, you know, the other part of elections that we haven't really touched upon is the money that goes into this. You know, as long as it is true that money doesn't always count, but money does matter in elections. And so I think you have a combination of parties that have, you know, taken for granted groups, but not really given them voice. Others who are now shunning them.
And I'm going to have to stop you there. Sorry, Nina, that's all the time we have for. But we will be picking up this conversation on Wednesday. We will be doing a postmortem on the primary for the big election day tomorrow. By the way, we've got a voter's edge guide if you check out our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Maria de los Angeles Torres from UIC and Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you missed a conversation, you can download our podcast on iTunes. We're on Twitter at 21st Show, and on Facebook, you can search for the 21st Show. A big part of our program will be introducing you to people and places across our state. It's not often that a college student lands on a Forbes 30 under 30 list, but Patrick Slade got there with his company, Psionic, which he co-founded with Adil Akhtar. Both are students at the University of Illinois, and both join us now in studio. Hey, guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So Psionic is creating a different kind of prosthetic hand. What's unique about it?
Well, basically, there's a couple factors. So the one thing that we can do different is a low-cost version of the existing hands. So we can achieve the same performance factors for about 10 times less cost. And then we also incorporate a lot of sensory feedback.
So no commercial prosthetic device has any form of sensory feedback, meaning that if I were to lose my hand and I was fitted with a prosthetic device, if I tried to touch the table, I wouldn't be able to feel it. And if I closed my eyes and I moved my prosthetic fingers around, I would have no idea where they are. We're actually able to give both of those forms of feedback to the user.
Okay. And Adil, I wonder if you can share with us what got you interested in creating prosthetic devices in the first place.
Sure. So when I was 7 years old, I was visiting Pakistan for one of the first times that I could remember. And that was actually the first time that I met an amputee. And she happened to be my age, hobbling towards me using a broken tree branch as a crutch, and she was missing her right leg. And at the time, I had wondered, you know, we share the same ethnic heritage. We're both Pakistani, but we have such vastly different qualities of life. And as I grew older, I began to realize that, you know, this was because it was due to a lack of resources for her, right? She didn't have security or financial resources or healthcare resources. And since then, that kind of spurred my interest in wanting to build prosthetic devices for the developing world.
Patrick, how expensive, when you said that, I mean, when we're listening to Adil talk about the expense involved, what's the difference in price between what you guys are creating versus what's commercially available on the market right now?
Yeah, so the commercial devices existing now are about $30,000 to $40,000. And we're
so
looking
completely out of reach then for, I would imagine, for most people.
Yeah, very select few, and especially only in the United States due to access. But our device will be made for about $1,000, so we're hoping to target a price of $3,000. And that's fully covered by insurance, so we can get it to the user for hopefully no out-of-pocket cost.
And Patrick, you're from Libertyville, right?
Yeah.
When did you first start getting interested in robotics and engineering?
So it's actually high school. I started working on a lot of independent projects, and I built a prosthetic arm that we brought, or that I brought down to U of I when I started here. And through a mutual connection, I got started working with Adil with that actual arm.
And how did that lead to Psionic? How did this happen?
Well, so we formed a collaboration with this nonprofit organization known as the Range of Motion Project. And so that was founded by an alumnus of the University of Illinois named David Krupa. And he was coming back in town to win an international humanitarian award for founding this company. And thing is, talks on prosthetics here are few and far between. So we were like, you know, we need to talk to this guy and tell him that, hey, we're 3D printing our own prosthetics. Are you interested? And so that led to us going down to Ecuador, where David Krupa got the U.S. Embassy to sponsor us.
You took a 3D printer to Ecuador?
No. So we took a 3D printed hand.
Okay.
Down to Ecuador.
Great. Yes. You took the hand, just the hand. Okay.
Yeah, and so when we got it to actually work on an actual patient who had lost his arm 30 years prior, when we came back, we were like, we can actually, you know, make this a viable business.
And when did you, did you basically decide we want to do this cheaply, 3D printing is the way to go, Patrick?
Yeah, so initially we thought 3D printed, we could make them for about $200, $300, and we thought that would be a big game changer, especially for developing nations where cost and access is a big issue, so you could 3D print your own wherever you are as long as you have a printer. But once we talked to the prosthetists in the U.S., they said the real problem for them was the durability of the hands, so we decided to pivot our idea, and initially for the U.S. market, just look at making a slightly more expensive version, about $1,000, but make it much more robust than the existing versions.
And when you say that, you're talking about printing prosthetic, and let's just stick with the hand right now. So it's a prosthetic device that's printed by 3D printer, and then it has sensory attachments to it as well. How does that, where does the sensory kind of part come from?
Sure. So in the fingertips of the middle index and thumb, we've got two pressure sensors. And these pressure sensors, they're low-cost barometric pressure sensors that's in everyone's cell phones and GPS devices. They cost less than $4. And what we do is we can inject a bit of silicone over it, and it turns into a highly sensitive touch sensor then, all for like around like $20 total.
Wow. And why, I imagine, maybe you should explain why the touch part is important, because is that for for controlling? Does the touch control sort of like how fast you pick something up or how hot it is, or why is that an issue?
So for we can give you an example. We work with a local amputee. His name is he's a retired sergeant, Garrett Anderson. And one of the things that he had told us was that when he was first fitted with his normal myoelectric prosthetic device, he went to shake his grandmother's hand, and he ended up crushing it because he couldn't detect how much force he was applying from his hand. So with these pressure sensors, and what we can do is we can actually control, he'll be able to control how much force he's applying and know how much force he's applying so that he doesn't end up breaking fragile objects.
What is it? So then, what does it feel like to get that? How do you know? I guess the question is, how are you replacing an actual hand and the feedback that happens with a biological hand? How is that signaling happening back to the brain?
Sure. So we've got the pressure sensors that are in the fingertips. And then what we do is we take those pressure sensors and the pressure reading that we're getting from it, we relay to the residual limb of the user through electrical stimulation.
So you get like a little zzz or something?
Yeah, so it feels like a tingling or a vibration. And sometimes we can even get it to feel like pressure. And that's really what we want to target.
Patrick, as you're listening to Adil sort of describe kind of the neurofeedback side, have you handled kind of more of the physical side of developing the prosthetic hand? How do you guys divide up your roles in the company?
Yeah, so initially when I joined the lab, Adil had been working on this sensory feedback for about 2 years. And then as a mechanical engineering student, I was very interested in how we could make the hand and how we could make it better and cheaper. And so that's kind of when I started leading the development of these low-cost mechanical hands, and then we connect them to make this really nice package where we can both make the device for low cost but also add this essential part of sensory feedback so the user can really get the full use out of their device.
And is there a trade-off between creating a prosthetic hand that's sort of high-performing, that has this kind of feedback that you guys are talking about, as well as being low-cost, or not really as much?
For us, for this sensory feedback, it's been a challenge to develop the technology because nothing like it exists in the commercial sphere. But like Adil was saying, the sensors are very low cost, and the way we design the hands, we do it in an intelligent manner so that they're just as useful, but they're also much cheaper to make. So together, it hasn't been a very expensive platform.
You guys incorporated your company a couple months ago, Psionic.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, which is interesting as we, how old are you? Do you mind if I ask, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm 21.
A deal?
29.
Okay, so what was the process of that like, you all deciding, okay, we've got this idea, we're now taking it to different countries to test it out, now we're going to create a company?
Yeah, it was about a year ago or a year and a half that we started taking some entrepreneurship, like boot camps and competitions, and we did them at U of I, San Francisco, Boston, and we really started to like the idea of spinning this out of research to make an actual impact, especially once we went to Ecuador and started working with actual patients.
Yeah, and one of the things that I feel strongly about is a lot of research that's in the labs, they never really make it out of the lab. And I just wanted to make sure that the stuff that we were doing was going to help the people who needed it around the world.
So what are the next steps for your company? What's the plan next?
So we'll be working this summer on rapidly developing our first prototype, our first commercial prototype, the one that we'll be actually hopefully mass producing and selling. And so we're planning on trying to crowdfund some money and also looking to actually do some longer term testing and more robust testing of the device so that we can get it to patients and make it useful.
And so we're aiming for, so the window for getting registered with the FDA, so not necessarily approval. We don't need FDA approval for just doing control of myoelectric prosthetic devices. But that's between October and December, so we hope to hit that time window and then get covered by insurance as early as next spring.
Yep.
And do you guys need to patent what you've done, or is the idea that you want this to be something that's shareable, that other, I don't know how that works when you're talking about 3D printing.
Yeah, so all of our past designs through research have been open source. For this device, it's actually very difficult to make because it relies on a lot of custom electronics and it's not 3D printed. So we won't be open sourcing this one. We will just be trying to produce it for less cost.
And I wonder, I mean, obviously there's probably a big industry of established prosthetic device companies that you guys are maybe changing a little bit the way they do business. Have you heard from other people in the industry who are doing this?
So there exists a lot of like open source designs and people doing very small scale. So tens of hands. So we're trying to change the game a little bit because these devices are so expensive and they reach so few people. It's definitely new territory, but we're not sure what's going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah, and another thing about the open source devices is that a lot of them don't go through clinicians or the route of becoming an actual medical device. And we want to make sure that if we're going to get this out to people, we want to do it right. And so that's why we've been, like, talking to clinicians and working with amputees with clinicians in order to make sure that this will function as a proper medical device for you rather than just something that, you can just build off the shelf and is unreliable.
So, Adil, you are an MD, PhD student at the University of Illinois.
Yes.
And, Patrick, you're a senior in mechanical science and engineering
yep.
at U of I. And, of course, you're the co-founders of this company, Psionic. I guess my question for you guys is, what's next for you in terms of are you hoping Psionic will sort of be your company in the future, or is this going to be one company? You guys are going to finish your degrees. What's the plan?
So so we're both finishing up our degrees this semester. Yay, finally.
Congratulations.
And so the idea is that within the next year we're going to go like kind of all out on Psionic and see how far it gets. And I mean, with startups, it's really hard to tell a lot of times like how what's going to happen. So we'll see.
Patrick, what about you? What are your plans after graduation? Is it full time Psionic or graduate school or what or both?
So this summer it'll definitely be full time Psionic, and then I'll be starting graduate school next fall. But still working with the deal. Most of our actual product design and commercial production will be done, and we'll just be trying to get FDA coverage and insurance coverage, which will be the real critical factor to whether our hand gets picked up by clinicians all across the U.S., which would make us a successful startup.
When you guys had this idea originally, did you think that it was going to end up where you are now with Patrick? You're on a Forbes 30 under 30 list. You incorporated a company. You're talking to the FDA about how to get this device accepted. Did you think that you guys would be going this far?
Definitely not.
Nope.
It's snowballed from just like random connection between Adil and I and the other awesome lab group members that we work with. And it's been very interesting and fun.
That said, Adil, you said you feel really strongly that you're probably around a lot of students or other researchers who have ideas, but maybe don't necessarily take them out into something that it's become a reality. And you guys, in your case, you really want to help amputees in developing countries. What advice do you have for people who maybe are at the idea stage but haven't gotten as far as you guys have?
I would say a lot of it is just putting the time and effort into building something. And like whatever prototype of whatever product you're going to do, you just have to do it.
Patrick, what about you?
Yeah, it's definitely a matter of caring enough about the problem, validating the market, and then really going after it and pursuing it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, is it really important for you guys to have business classes, all these other things? Or do you think you kind of have learned the startup mentality while you were, Patrick, you were in the engineering school, and Adil, you're in the you're also in engineering, right?
Yeah.
You're in a couple places. I was going to say, how many schools are you in? A couple different schools, right?
And so I guess the thing is that's why we took a lot of the courses through the Technology Entrepreneur Center at U of I, because they helped us to understand a lot of the business aspect of things and how to commercialize the technology that we're developing.
That's Adil Akhtar, Patrick Slade, both of them co-founders of Psionic. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to our debut of the 21st. We hope today's giving you an idea of what we want to accomplish with the show. We think it's crucial now more than ever for all of us to not just be talking, but listening to each other. Our promise to you is that every time we're on the air, we'll bring you the news, culture, and stories that matter to Illinois. This is your chance to hear voices from all across the state. We want to serve as your connection to the people, places, communities, and most importantly, conversations that are happening here. We're called the 21st, by the way, not just because we're the 21st state, but because we want this to be 21st century radio. So you can always find us online. You can search for The 21st Show on Facebook, follow 21st Show on Twitter, or leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. If you can't remember all of that, just remember our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks for talking to us and listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is The 21st.